It is not hard to destroy a college.
Last season, the podcast Campus Files brought you stories of fraternity drug rings, stolen body parts, campus cults, and more.
And now Campus Files is back for another season.
There's a guy screaming into his phone. He's like, I just saw Charlie Kirk get assassinated right in front of me.
Every week is a new episode and a new story.
It was so chaotic.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news, social media, video games, isolation, depression. Mental health or behavioral disorders affect nearly one quarter of children in the U.S., and almost half of those kids don't get treatment, according to new research. Why is that? Here's more with KCBS in San Francisco.
Dr. Megan Cole, Associate Professor of Population Medicine at Harvard Medical School. This is such an important topic. Let's start kind of broad here. What are some of the leading issues that kids today are facing?
We see increasing evidence of mental health related needs across kind of children and adolescents. This includes increasing rates of anxiety, especially, but also depression, ADHD, and trauma-related disorders as well. And I think there's a lot of drivers kind of underlying this, largely kind of due to increases in symptoms over time, where I think a lot of other work suggests that exposure to social media, screen time, increasing academic pressures, in addition to the COVID-19 pandemic, have really elevated these issues year over year.
Yeah, I want to dig a little deeper into the social media aspect in just a moment. But, I don't know how many times, just as an observer, I said, boy, it is a lot harder to be a kid these days than it was when I was a kid. Do you think that's true?
I do. I think that's true. And our study doesn't look at this specifically, but I think we see from a lot of other work that over time, what it looks like to be a child or adolescent now is not what it looked like kind of when we were children. I think the experiences are changing over time. This includes, like I mentioned, kind of increased access to screens and social media, really kind of constant access and distractions and pressures that we may not have once had, and in addition to kind of heightened academic and competitive pressures. And really the way we're seeing this present within the healthcare system is kind of increasing needs to access mental health care over time, especially for anxiety.
I wonder, are kids facing more pressures and more problems today, or are we doing a better job of observing and diagnosing it? Or I suppose it could be both.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it really is both. We aren't able to decouple this in the particular study that we just published, but we do see evidence really of two things. I think when we just measure symptoms over time in pediatric and adolescent populations, we see over time heightened reports of feeling symptoms of anxiety, depression, or indications of ADHD. So I do think there are kind of real symptom level drivers, and there are a lot of mechanisms that are driving those symptoms. But at the same time, we also have improved screening over time, which is great. We now have improved protocols and screening recommendations such that increasingly as children and adolescents go into their doctor's offices, they're now being screened systematically at an increasing rate for some of these things, which in turn means that the providers are able to detect those issues and ideally link them to treatment if they can actually kind of get them into treatment.
You mentioned social media earlier. A KCBS listener asks, how has social media impacted the rise of mental health issues in children?
Yeah, it's an important question. I'll say I have personally haven't done research in this space, but it's something I think about a lot and a lot of other researchers think about it. And I think there's overwhelming evidence that social media has contributed to feelings of anxiety, of depression, and kind of related to that as increases in screen time, increases over time that also kind of affect the ability of children and adolescents to really pay attention. And we kind of can see that play out as we see increases in ADHD diagnoses over time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I just wonder, I mean, again, not to date myself, but back when I was a kid, if you were going to be bullied, it probably happened at school. But now, yes, there can be physical bullying at school, but you go home, you look at your phone, people are making fun of you. I mean, For children who are on the receiving end of bullying, it's nonstop. You can't escape it.
I think it's really difficult, and it's in our pocket 24/7. You see what other people are doing, or you see if you're included or not included. And there's just, I think, a lot more that children and adolescents are exposed to constantly through the use of social media and screens.
Here's a great question from a KCBS listener. How did COVID impact mental health in children? Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. I think we see a lot of evidence that the COVID-19 pandemic contributed to increasing feelings of anxiety and depression. I think it also really disrupted some critical developmental years for children and adolescents, including kind of disruptions of schooling and disruptions of kind of what otherwise would have been typical socialization. And in our data, you know, we see a lot of the trends in, say, anxiety increases really predating the pandemic. So these trends were already increasing over time. But then what you see is subsequent to the pandemic, we really see rates of mental health related needs accelerate at a greater rate because of the pandemic.
I wonder if you can draw a line, a correlation between kids who maybe missed out on some social interaction growth because they were, you know, learning from home, learning remotely during the pandemic. And now, you know, are they kind of behind the eight ball when it comes to their social development? And is this affecting their mental health?
Yeah, I think there's evidence by a lot of other researchers that suggests that's true. I think the socialization or kind of isolation, particularly in the immediate years of the pandemic, has been shown to have negatively impacted children's mental health as they weren't as well connected to peers during that time. And I think on the schooling end, there's also a lot of evidence that it has put a lot of youth behind in terms of their academic development as well.
We mentioned early on that nearly half of the kids who should be getting mental health treatment are not receiving adequate treatment. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think there's a couple of reasons. So I think one of the really big drivers is access to mental health specialists within our healthcare system, where we have a lot of children who present within the healthcare system who might screen positive for having a mental health need. And when they go to become linked to a specialist for treatment, they are unable to get an appointment or their treatment is very delayed. And I think part of what this suggests, particularly along with the study that we just published, as we're seeing more and more of these issues present within primary care, I think this suggests an increasing need to really equip primary care practices, particularly pediatric primary care practices, with the training, the staffing, and the resources really embedded into those settings such that children can better access care within settings where we already know they're accessing care, which is pediatric primary care. And kind of another challenge in this space, the reason why it may be hard to access a specialist is because we really don't have enough behavioral health specialists within pediatrics, and we have even fewer who accept insurance. And particularly if you're enrolled in Medicaid or public insurance, it becomes even harder to find a specialist who will accept your insurance. So yet another reason why primary care is really, I think, increasingly important setting where we can think about addressing these needs.
So technology is part of the problem, but could it also be the answer? Adam and Jordana on WCCO in Minneapolis discusses if AI therapy is right for kids.
Sometimes it feels like the news is full of things that have never happened before. And that is not exactly true. In fact, it may have happened this very week, hundreds or thousands of years ago. I'm Sally Helm, host of the podcast History This Week from the History Channel. Trade embargoes? Thomas Jefferson tried them. Rent too high? We've been arguing about that for a while. Each episode is proof. The past isn't that far away. Listen to History This Week, available now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I have to be honest, I'm super skeptical about apps that act as therapists for my kids. If my kids are struggling with their mental health, and we know this as parents, we're so in tune with that and so concerned about the mental health of our teens, I don't know if I'm ready to turn that care over to an AI app. Am I right in having these reservations? Let's ask our guest. Robbie Torney is head of AI and digital assessments at Common Sense Media, and we're having Robbie on because they've looked at a lot of these apps that provide mental health services specifically for young people and teenagers. Robbie, thank you for joining us. You're on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker app. Am I right to be skeptical about these apps?
Hey, Adam, thanks for having us. You are absolutely right to be skeptical about these apps. The app that's most likely to end up on your teen's phone has no way to tell the difference between a teen that's having a bad day and a teen that's having a psychiatric emergency. And when the app gets it wrong, there's no human oversight, no person to catch the mistake.
How many of these apps are out there, and how many did your group look at? And take us through the process of how you examined these apps and whether or not they do what they purport to do.
So we've previously done research on using AI chatbots like ChatGPT for mental health support for teens, and we've rated that use case as unacceptably risky for a lot of the same reasons. This study is looking at apps that are purpose-built for mental health support, and there are tons of these apps on the App Store and on the Play Store. They say things like that they've been designed by clinicians, that they're providing therapy. We looked at 5 apps in this assessment, 3 that are direct to consumer, which means anyone can download them, and 2 that are available to schools. And in this small slice, we looked at apps that have more than 10 million users overall. So this is a fast-growing big market. Some of the market research we looked at said that this is a space that's expected to grow into the billions of dollars of revenue by the end of this decade.
You said something that I guess I wasn't aware of, that some schools are using these. Which ones are you talking about, and how widespread are they being used in schools?
Yeah, well, the good news is that the products that we looked at that are designed to be used in schools are designed to be integrated into the ways that schools help kids who are having mental health needs. They connect to the counselors that are at the schools. They connect into the school's infrastructure. And those apps were less risky, but you can understand why schools would be interested in using AI or tech support with this, because the teen mental health crisis is real and well established, and it's been a challenge for schools to be able to provide services that kids need, especially coming out of the pandemic.
Which ones that you looked at are the most troublesome?
So WISA is one of the most popular AI therapy apps that teens can download and use, and we scored that as an unacceptable risk. This app failed to recognize signs of psychiatric emergencies. It maintained eating disorders. When we provided it with signs and symptoms of eating disorders, it said that we were doing a great job with our weight loss plan, and it didn't have any human oversight for when something goes on. There were other apps that we found that we had serious concerns about, but I think one of the big things that parents should hear is, because there's no accountability in this space, over our testing cycle, 2 of these apps serving more than 3 million users just disappeared from the App Store. That's like if your kid's therapist just poof disappeared from their lives with no follow-up, no notice, no plan for transition. So the lack of accountability and the lack of regulation in the space is definitely a big part of this story.
That's frightening that there's no human oversight of that site. We're talking to Robbie Torney. He's head of AI and digital assessments at Common Sense Media. I would think that is problematic for that company, that they would be open to a number of lawsuits, and maybe they already are. If there's been tragic outcomes where you've got a student or a young person using this site, and sadly that teen took his or her own life, and somehow there's evidence that this app didn't do anything or missed warning signs. I mean, have we seen that they have faced lawsuits because of things like that?
To be clear, our testing didn't actually look at whether real teens were engaging in psychiatric emergencies. Our researchers, including clinical psychiatrists, simulate teenagers who are in crisis and look at how these apps would respond to them. It's not difficult to imagine, though. We've already seen a large number of lawsuits brought against AI chatbot companies when their chatbots didn't interrupt or appropriately respond to teens who were engaging in suicidal ideation or talking about self-harm. There have unfortunately been real teens who have harmed themselves or others as a result of their interactions with AI chatbots. I think, though, in this space, one of the key takeaways is pretty much anyone can say that they have an AI app that does therapy. They can put it online. It's not subject to the same oversight or regulation that a real therapist is. And if that therapy app disappears or does something wrong, there's really no recourse for the parent or the teen that would be harmed as a result of using these apps. So because of that lack of accountability and because of the unreliability that we found in our testing, we encourage teens and parents to not use these AI therapy apps.
I mean, I can see the appeal. Therapy is expensive. As somebody who's been to many therapists, I know it's expensive. It's time consuming. You have to drive a person to these locations. And I see the appeal of, hey, there's something online you can do at home to check in with somebody. For those parents who say, boy, this maybe my teen is exploring some of these, are there any ones that you looked at that did do what they were saying or that parents could feel comfortable in having their teen use?
Yeah, so first, we didn't look at apps that your doctor, your therapist might prescribe to you and right. use as part of a treatment plan. That's a different use case because you have a medical professional that's overseeing your care and is checking in on you. So if your kid is using one of those apps that a doctor has prescribed to them, the findings of the study likely don't apply. Second, I think the school-based apps that we tested, Sonar and Alongside, one of the things that was really good about these apps is when we simulated a teen being in trouble, we got a phone call from a real human being to our parent phone number, to our school phone number saying, hey, this student or your child is having an emergency. We think you should take them to the emergency room. We think you should check in on them and make sure they're okay. That's not the norm with these other apps that we tested where they lose signs of crisis. They don't respond. They don't provide helplines. So I think, unfortunately, the market overall is probably not at a place where the technology is ready to do what it's promising to do. And look, we see the appeal too. We know that it's hugely expensive and hugely maybe inconvenient to access therapy or maybe difficult to actually find a therapist. But one other thing that I would just highlight as a risk here when I'm talking about these disappearing apps is all of that sensitive medical data, the things that users were disclosing to the AI therapist that they were talking about, their biggest challenges, their deepest secrets, their most intimate problems. That data is gone, but it's not really gone. It's somewhere right. on the internet. It's not clear how it's being used. So there's a risk also in using these services if they disappear and then your data pops up somewhere else.
That's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying to think about that. What kind of regulation is there of these sites, if any?
There is little regulation, which is, I think, one of the reasons why we have this Wild West that we're describing. Right now, I mean, this is certainly an area where we recommend that policymakers consider whether these mental health apps should be regulated like medical devices. And we suggest that the FDA evaluate its pre-certification program accordingly. There's also regulation that we think that's needed to require transparency about what these products actually do. Like several apps say that they provide science-guided emotional support or that they're proven effective, but you can't make those types of claims about other types of treatments. And this is a place where the FDA and regulators should be taking a very, very careful look, given the high stakes associated with use of these apps.
Robbie, last question for you. Your advice to parents, hearing what you're talking about, just like many other things when it deals with medical and the health of our kids, is to trust your doctor. My takeaway is that if your kid is struggling with some mental health, talk to the doctor and the doctor can direct you to legitimate sites. Is that your advice? Is there any sort of other advice that, hey, some of these are okay, or is it simply you need to talk to your doctor about these?
I think it's that parents need to talk to teens about AI and mental health. Teens, we know from our research at Common Sense Media that many teens are already turning to general purpose AI chatbots like ChatGPT for emotional support and mental health support. A survey we ran last year showed that almost half of teens do this regularly. This is not a niche use of AI, and it's just really critical that teens recognize that AI chatbots don't have judgments, don't know how to identify risk signs, don't know when they might be in trouble. And while the industry is working hard to improve the safety of their products, the products aren't quite there yet. So I think this is an opportunity for us as families and as school communities to have conversations about what we want AI to do in our lives and what we don't want AI to do in our lives and why. And I think this is a place where, you know, as alluring and as supportive as it may feel to have that non-judgmental chatbot talking with you, the chatbots don't respond or provide the types of advice that a real caring human being would. They can't. They're not humans. They're programs. They're machines. And it's important to talk about that so that teens themselves can start to recognize the profit motive that exists behind wanting them to use these services.
If AI therapy is a risk, there's another new type of therapy you may want to consider. Here's Tommy Tucker on WWL.
The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jordan Generous, CEO of NeuroJust and BioJust. What is transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS?
Sure. So it's a non-medication-based treatment for depression, anxiety, OCD. It's also indicated for smoking cessation, mainly because smoking is, you know, a coping mechanism for anxiety for some people. It's actually approved for adolescents 15 and over. So even 15 and over can get it. It's been proven to be safe and effective in patients. So it's a non-medication-based treatment for these disorders. And I hear you talking about this all the time that, you know, it's not unlike any other physical injury that you have in your body.
It's
not. And that's exactly, yeah, it is actually a physical injury in your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this addresses that physical imbalance in the brain. It's an activity level imbalance that this actually treats. So it's more like physical therapy for the brain. You know, if you had a hip imbalance, which causes back pain, you know, if you go to physical therapy, you know, and you balance out your hips, you're going to address the root cause of that pain and inflammation, just like depression, anxiety is a symptom of a neurological imbalance. Unfortunately, we've all been programmed to believe it's a chemical imbalance, which has actually been disproven. It's all based off of the serotonin hypothesis that was developed about 40, 50 years ago, that serotonin causes depression, anxiety, or an imbalance of it. Well, that's actually in the last 3 years have been disproven. So it's not a chemical imbalance. It's actually a functional imbalance in the brain. And this trains the brain to come back into balance.
How does it do that? If you can give us a layman's explanation of that.
Sure. So when you use an electromagnetic pulse on the body, you can actually stimulate an electrical current in a neuron, right? So if I did it in your arm, your hand would start to jump because it would send a signal down those nerve fibers to work. Now, the neurons in the brain that we're actually treating are located in a specific region of the brain. It doesn't control motor function, right? So it doesn't make your body move, but it controls the way you think. So this part of the brain that's called the prefrontal cortex, it actually controls your personality, but it also controls your logic, your reasoning, your rational thoughts, focus, your attention, right? And in these brain scans that we've done in these large clinical trials, what we see is this part of the brain is underactive in people with depression, anxiety. And that is the part of the brain that governs your ability to control your negative intrusive thoughts that come from a different part of the brain. So when it's depressed, when it's low activity...
Wait, say that part again, Jordan. Say that part again, because mm-hmm. I'm trying to stay with you there.
Sure. So if you think about two sides of the brain, right, two parts of the brain that control your thought processes, okay? One part of the brain is called the limbic region, and that's your fight or flight center, okay? So what we see in these large trials that are done with brain scans, the large trials done by like Dr. Amen out of Texas, he did a large study with 500 patients, and what he sees is one part of the brain in patients with depression and anxiety is about three times more active than it should be, and that's called the limbic region. So that's the part of the brain that sends you the thoughts of fight or flight, okay? So in patients with depression and anxiety, that part of the brain is just constantly running. It's constantly sending you these worries, concerns, stresses, depressed thoughts. Now, the prefrontal cortex is also more dormant in these same patients, right? So the prefrontal cortex is the filter for these intrusive thoughts. You know, it tells you, you know, even subconsciously that's not really a worry or concern that we need to, you know, even think about. So when it's working like it should, it actually governs that limbic region and it controls it.
So while we think of the thought process or emotions as an ethereal thing, it's actually a physiological thing. Is that accurate?
100%.
Okay. How does it get out of balance to begin with, Jordan?
Well, what I see most often in my patients is that they're battling this issue since they're, you know, usually teenagers, puberty time frame or pre-puberty. They're seeing, you know, usually anxiety at that age. Mm-hmm. Okay, so some form of trauma threw them into this imbalance at a young age. So when they were younger, they either had a chemical trauma or physical trauma, like a traumatic brain injury, or some emotional trauma. Well, while we're young, we have all this neuroplasticity, right? We're still trying to assign functions to the brain and trying to teach it how to work properly. When they're young, when our patients are young, they typically get thrown into this state where they're using the limbic region much more than they're using the prefrontal cortex. So,
which means, go back, let me take you back a step, which means they're using the limbic region more than the prefrontal cortex, which means...
Yeah. They're training that part of their brain to operate that way.
Right, and it results
It's not an intentional thing. It's not something they're planning to do, right?
But going back to what the limbic region does and what the prefrontal cortex does, mm-hmm. by doing that, it results in...
depression and anxiety because... Okay. So what happens is this neuroplasticity, right? We're training the brain to work like it should, right? You can learn really good languages really easily when you're young. You're still forming these synapses and these neural pathways. Well, when you're young and you get thrown into the state of, you know, some traumatic situation throws you into the limbic region, if you stay in it for too long, as your neuroplasticity starts to slow down around 16 on average, it starts to slow down all the way to you're about 26. Oftentimes what happens is our patients say they felt anxious at a young age, and then they get diagnosed depression sometime between like 16 and 26.
Gotcha.
And that's because the neuroplasticity has slowed down, and now they're kind of stuck in this constant state of fight or flight.
In essence, they have trained their brain to do that.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about it, when you're growing up, right, if you're sometime around, you know, puberty years, if all you did was, you know, curls on your right arm, right? Mm-hmm. You never use your left arm. Well, your right arm would be a lot bigger than your left arm. Well, it's all about whether or not you use it or you lose it, right? So if you're using the limbic region while your brain is still adaptable, well, then you're using the limbic region so much that it trains the brain to use that region of the brain all the time.
Treatment that is done, correct me if I'm saying anything wrong here, Jordan, with magnetic waves, correct?
Correct. And those magnetic pulses, correct the issue.
Magnetic pulses. Sorry. Jordan Generous is our guest, CEO of NeuroJust and BioJust. It's helped me a lot. It is National Mental Health Awareness Month. This thing has been around 30 years. It's FDA approved, as you've heard me say, and a lot of insurance companies, most insurances accept it. So it's been thoroughly vetted, and I just think this is something that a lot of people can benefit from, and that's why I'm taking the time to share it with you, and I want Jordan to explain this. Somebody texted in and said, I just tuned in. What's the name of this medication? If anything, it's a substitute to another medication, correct?
Correct. Now, we don't start, stop, change any medications during treatment. So if patients are on medications, we don't stop those. We use no medications here. This is an actual physical treatment to your brain where it actually trains your brain to work as it should in balance between the two parts of the brain that send you conscious thoughts. So the magnetic pulses forces a neuron to activate. So basically the electrical impulse in those neurons will now activate. And we do about 3,000 pulses per treatment. And over the course of 36 treatments, we activate that part of the brain about 150,000 times. Now, we're doing this at the exact frequency the brain should be operating at. So we're basically just training that part of the brain to work exactly like it should.
From the moment I walk in, what's going to happen?
We qualify you with your insurance, which just about every insurance covers this, even Medicaid. So commercial insurance, Medicare, TRICARE, VA, doesn't really matter. It all covers TMS as long as you have mental health benefits. So it's a tapping, twitching sensation in your scalp. So, of course, if we're activating neurons, we're activating the nerves in your scalp. So you will have like a twitching, tapping sensation where the magnet is located. It's not painful at all. It's a little uncomfortable, but it's not painful at all. You can attest to that, I'm sure.
Yep.
So I would compare it to like putting a tinge unit on your scalp. If anybody's experienced a tinge unit on their body during physical therapy, you know, or a treatment like that. So it's painless. It's non-invasive. You don't have to be sedated at all. You drive to and from. The treatment lasts about 10 to 20 minutes, and we get you in and out very quickly, and it's a very peaceful atmosphere with which you get treatment.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
The Recap Show is an inside look for fans into the world of global soccer, women's sports, and all things gal culture.
From the inside perspective of two World Cup champions and Olympians.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.